music. I can't get enough of that shit. Sheckley had me torn some honky-tonk clubs over there 4 or 5 times. Good money. Yeah. I held up the CD I'd been looking at earlier. What's this, Russian? Cam grunted. He was drinking more beer, warming up to the subject. Fan sent that to me with a real nice letter. Said it wasn't playing right anymore, and she loved it. Could I please send her a copy of the American original? Good-looking girl, too. You sent it? Couldn't. There's no original. It's a bootleg of one of my shows in Munich. Half the titles in there are boots. Hell, half the titles in Europe. Now you gonna tell me about Alex B.?
I put the CDs aside.
I came here to help you, Cam.
He stopped with his beer can halfway to his mouth, put the can down.
Well, a fact. You get me fired one day, now you gonna help me.
Alex Blankeagle was shot dead. He blinked, kept his eyes closed a second too long.
And what's that got to do with me?
He was talking to a man named Samuel Barrera about Sheckley's business. In particular, those shipments you've been helping process through the Indian paintbrush. Cam put together a smile. He rubbed the bruise on his forehead.
I ain't been close to Sheck for a long time, son. Last help I gave him was signing up with Miranda's band. Look where that got me. Sheck has some other kind of problem that ain't mine.
I know different, Cam. Samuel Barrera's ex-FBI, and he's very good. He'll come talking to you eventually. With something like this, he'll have customs involved, the state attorney, the DA. You want my guess? Sheck and his friends know something is coming. They know Les St. Pierre caused a leak, and they're plugging up any places where it might have come from. Julie Kearns, Alex Blankeagle, you. If I were you, I'd be worried. Cam looked at his beer, thought for about 5 seconds, then decided to laugh.
That's bullshit.
Ask Alex Blankeagle if it's bullshit. I opened my backpack and pulled out Cam's .22 Montgomery Ward. I set the gun next to me on the amp.
You could have killed John Cray, Cam. Not likely, but possible.
Cam looked at the gun, and his eye ticked.
What you going on about now? What's that for?
I suppose the demo tape's around here somewhere, too. You wouldn't be smart enough to trash it. You think I should give this to the police, Cam? Tell them where I found it? I could tell them what idiot it's registered to and how he probably forgot to wipe the inside of the chamber for prints. They put this together with the Julie Kearns murder, the way that was done. Guess who's going to get the blame? Under his bruises, Cam got red-faced. He stood up real slow, holding his beer can as if he were about to throw it.
Wait a goddamn minute.
When it comes to Sheckley's helpers, you're at the bottom of the food chain, Cam. I bet he didn't even pay you. I bet he just knows how to get you riled up, how to put ideas in your head of things he wants done. He's got absolutely nothing to lose using you. And when people come knocking on his door with warrants for larger problems, you're the first sacrifice he's going to toss out. Sheckley's got you set up pretty good. Cam's eyes narrowed. The anger got diffused and tangled up inside him. He lowered the beer can.
And what you think I should do, son? Sit there and enjoy the knife in my back? How you think that feels? There's a time not too long ago I was in Miranda Daniels' corner pretty fierce. Even after she got with Mr. St. Pierre. I used to drive her to the paintbrush every night, nice and friendly. We talk about the business. She and me had an understanding. I was going to look after her. She's going to be my ticket somewhere else besides here.
He waved a hand around the apartment.
Look to you like I'm getting anywhere.
You figure she owes you, I said.
Damn right.
You figure the whole world owes you. You got an ego so big you collect your own bootlegs, Cam. Probably autograph them for yourself, too. I think your perception of what Miranda promised might be a wee bit twisted. He took a step forward.
You asking for something, son, you're gonna get it.
Knock it off, Cam. I want to get Miranda extricated from Sheckley so her deal with Century Records can go through. You could give me the leverage I need to do that. Cam laughed harshly. Heard that before. You mean from Les? Cam shook his head in disgust, walked stiffly into the kitchen, pulled another beer from the refrigerator.
Ask little Miss Daniels. Ask if I didn't tell her first time she came crying to me about Sheck's contract on her. I figured a Century Records deal, hell. She was gonna take me along for sure. We'd be set. I told her. Somebody wanted to get a little pull with Sheck. All they had to do was look into those shows he's been taping for radio, maybe get close to Julie Kearns. Ask Julie to pull some files here and there from the paintbrush computers. Ask her about those trips to Europe with Alex B.
I stood very still. The only sound was the hum of Cam Compton's refrigerator and the traffic on Perrin Vital. You told Miranda all this?
That's what I'm saying.
And if somebody was to dig where you said to dig? Cam gave me his closed-lipped smile.
Not like every sound man who's ever worked the paintbrush doesn't know. Not like the headliner artists don't know, son. It's rankled them for years, just nobody can prove it. I tell you, what do I get?
I'll introduce you to Sam Barrera. Make sure he cuts you a fair deal.
Price would be higher than that, son.
Somebody's already kicked in your ribs, Cam. You think you can afford to wait around for a better offer? Cam's smile dissolved.
Get the fuck out, then.
You should talk to me, Cam. He went across the room, retrieved his .22 from the guitar amp. He held it lazily in my direction, never mind the chambers were empty. There wasn't much more I could say. I opened the door. The heat immediately sucked into the room around me, along with the traffic sounds and the smell of exhaust. As I left, Cam Compton was standing in front of his music collection, his .22 wedged in his armpit. Cam was examining one by one the stray CDs I'd taken out, using his grubby T-shirt to wipe the front of each jewel case before he put it back in its proper place. Chapter 28. That night it took more than a little self-convincing to get myself out of the house, away from the possibilities of a simple chalupa dinner in my medieval drama book, and maybe even some sleep, to drive out instead to the address Miranda Daniels had given me, her family ranch house near Bulverde. It had been less than a year since an inheritance case had taken me out that direction, but I was amazed by the urbanization, how much farther I had to go to start smelling the cedars and the fertilizer. San Antonio grows in concentric layers like a tree. It's one of the few ways the town is orderly. My grandfather rarely went farther from downtown than Brackenridge Park, unless he was looking for deer to shoot. My mother used to think Scribner's Fabric Store on Loop 410 was the edge of town. In my high school years, the outermost boundary of the known world was Loop 1604. And even inside the loop, it was still mostly tracts of live oak and cactus and broken limestone. Now I could drive past 1604 and halfway to the village of Bulverde before I was ever out of earshot of a convenience store. The sky behind me was city gray-orange, and ahead of me, rural black. Just above the hills, the full moon made a hazy white circle behind the clouds. I exited on Ranch Road 22, a narrow two-laner, with no lighting, no posted speed limits, plenty of curves, and nothing on the shoulders but gravel and barbed wire. A kill way, my dad would have called it. In my gore-loving adolescent days, I used to pester the sheriff to tell me about all the traffic accidents he'd handled on little ranch roads like RR-22. He usually said no, but one night he'd gotten drunk enough and fed up enough to tell me in graphic detail about a particularly nasty head-on collision. He told me murder scenes were nothing compared to car accidents, and then he went on to prove it. I never asked to hear any more of his work stories. I swerved once to avoid a dead deer. Fence posts and mile markers floated into my headlights and out again. Occasionally, I passed a billboard advertising a new housing development that was about to be built. Calle Verde, fine living from the 120s. I bet the folks who'd moved out here for a retirement in the country were pleased about that. The 7-Elevens and HEBs would be coming in next. The turn for Sarah Road was unmarked, despite what Miranda had told me, and it wasn't much wider than a private driveway. Fortunately, I could see the Daniels party all the way from RR-22. A quarter mile or so across a dark pasture, lights were blazing in the trees and a fire was burning. There was the distant hum of music. I bumped along Sarah Road with rocks pinging into the wheel wells of the VW. The air was the temperature of bath water and had a strange mix of smells, manure, wood smoke, gasoline, and marigolds. One more right turn took me over to the cattle guard of the Daniels property. Their front yard was a full acre of gravel and grass. A dozen pickup trucks were parked around a granddaddy live oak several stories tall and hung from root to top with white Christmas lights. One of the pickup trucks was a huge black affair with orange pinstriping and silver Barbie doll women on the mud flaps. I wondered if there could be two such trucks in the world. Not with my luck. The house itself was low and long and white, with a front porch that stretched all the way across and was now spilling over with people. Willis Daniels and his stand-up bass were the center of attention. He and a small bunch of grizzled cowboy musicians, none of them from Miranda's group, were burning their way through an old swing number, Milton Brown, if my memories of my father's 78 collection served me right. All the players were drunk as hell, and they sounded just fine. Smaller clumps of people were gathered around the property, drinking and talking and laughing. Half a dozen were throwing horseshoes by the side of the house, their light provided by a line of bare bulbs strung between a mesquite tree and a tool shed. Some women in dresses and boots and lots of silver jewelry were gathered around a campfire, helping bleary-eyed kids roast marshmallows. All the pickup truck cabs were dark and closed, but not all of them were vacant. Next to the oak tree, two men were talking, Brent Daniels and my buddy Jean. Brent was wearing the same dingy checkered shirt and black jeans he'd been wearing the last three times I'd seen him. They weren't getting any prettier, and neither was he. His black hair looked like day-old roadkill. He was shifting uncomfortably from foot to foot. Jean wore a dark blue linen jacket, slacks that were a little too tight around his middle, a white collarless silk shirt, black boots, and a silver bracelet. His hand was clutching Brent's shoulder a little too firmly, and he was leaning close to Brent's ear, telling him something. When Jean realized somebody was watching their conversation, he cast around until he found me. He locked his fierce, indifferent little eyes on me for a second, finished his statement to Brent, then pulled away and laughed, patting Brent's shoulder like they'd just shared a fine, humorous story. Brent didn't laugh. He turned angrily and walked toward the house. Jean leaned back against the oak. He put his heel on the trunk, produced a hand-rolled cigarette, and began fishing around his pockets for a lighter. He watched me as I walked toward him. The steel guitar player. It's honest work. Jean lit his cigarette, nodded. No doubt, honest work. Why are you standing out here in the dark? I asked. Your boss too embarrassed to bring you into the party? Jean narrowed his eyes. He mouthed the words, your boss, like he was trying to interpret them, like he was suspicious he'd just been insulted. Sheckley, he decided. Yeah, the big ugly redneck, you know. In the glow from the white Christmas lights, Jean's smile looked unnaturally luminous. The fierceness in his eyes didn't diminish at all. I see. You did a hell of a job clearing out Alex Blanc-Eagle the other night. No response. Jean took a drag on the cigarette, turned his head, and blew smoke leisurely toward the porch. The old drunk musicians had launched into something new, an instrumental that sounded vaguely like Lester Scruggs. A couple of women were do-si-doing with each other on the sidewalk. I looked toward the front door. Brent Daniels now stood next to an ice-filled garbage can, drinking a beer as fast as he could. Several people were talking to him, but Brent wasn't paying them any attention. What was that about? I asked Jean. He followed my gaze, caught my meaning.
I told Brent Daniels I admired his sister, her music. I said, I hope she would tour Europe soon.
Like Cam Compton used to. Make a nice courier system, wouldn't it?
Good cover, touring with a band with lots of equipment, if you had goods you wanted to deliver to a lot of places in Europe.
Jean blew more smoke. He gave me the crab eyes.
Do you intend to provoke Mr. Navarre? Or are you simply an idiot?
I'm not usually like this, I confessed. Usually I don't find so many corpses in 1 week. You usually leave so many?
Jean smiled coldly. An idiot, he decided.
He disengaged his back from the tree and was leaning forward to say something when some commotion erupted around the side of the house. Somebody by the shed yelled, Oh! Like he'd just seen a great triple play. A woman shrieked. A crowd of people started to converge around the horseshoe pit. Some were swearing, a few laughing. Willis Daniels' hoedown faltered to a stop as the musicians got up to see what was going on. A drunk cowboy staggered away from the scene, laughing, telling people what had just happened in a loud enough voice that Jean and I could hear him fine. Apparently, Alison St. Pierre had just knocked Tilden Sheckley out cold with a horseshoe. I looked at Jean. He tossed a cigarette down in a leisurely way. It bounced off a root and disappeared in the crack between two other roots, then dimmed to a little orange eye. Jean looked up at me and smiled, almost pleasantly this time.
My boss, he said with satisfaction.
Then he turned and casually walked in the opposite direction, into the dark. Chapter 29. Sheckley wasn't out cold exactly, just slightly cooled down. I nudged my way through the spectators and found him sitting in the dust, his fingertips on his temples and a look of complete dismay on his face. He was dressed in black, from boots to shirt. His Stetson lay nearby, knocked from his head. Below Sheck's left eye, the cheek looked like a cross-section of a rare filet mignon. An inch higher, and the horseshoe would have blinded him. An older woman squatted next to him, patting his shoulders and trying to console him. Her words came out slurred. The margarita in her other hand sloshed at a 45-degree angle. A couple of cowboy types stood on the other side. They seemed anxious to lend the rich man a bandana or an arm to lean on or a gun to shoot Alison St. Pierre, anything he needed. Sheckley shook his head a couple of times. He dabbed at his ruined cheek with the back of his fist, looked at the blood on his knuckles, and regained some color in his face. Then he tried to get up and failed. He rallied again, staggering to his feet with the help of the cowboys.
I'm gonna kill that crazy bitch.
The men murmured agreement. Sheckley blinked. He stumbled, huge and awkward as a drugged horse. He scanned the crowd, targeted me briefly, and seemed to make a foggy connection. Then his eyes kept moving. Alison St. Pierre was nowhere to be seen, though a few people were looking in the direction of the ranch house and shaking their heads as they speculated about her. I went toward the house. When I bumped into Willis Daniels on the porch, he turned around and grabbed my upper arm, and for a second I thought the old man was going to clobber me with his cane. I hardly recognized him. The Santa Claus smile had vanished. His eyes blazed. His cement-colored hair was flattened into sweaty bangs against his forehead. He looked disappointed when he saw I wasn't someone he wanted to clobber, at least not at the moment.
Damn it, he muttered, lowering his cane.
Allison went this way? Willis raised his cane again and shook it at nobody in particular. Then he glared in the direction of the horseshoe pit and began grumbling things about Mrs. St. Pierre that weren't fit for Santa's elves to hear. I went inside. Stringed instruments decorated the walls. A couple of kids slept on a Naga hide couch in the living room while their parents told Aggie jokes and mixed drinks in the kitchen. The door to the first bedroom down the hall was open. A woman I didn't know had passed out on the bed in the middle of a pile of cowboy hats. The door to the second bedroom was ajar, and Allison's voice came through in a tone so shaky it made me wince. Like an E string, tuned to the point you just knew it was going to snap in the guitarist's face.
"He pushed me down," she yelled. "I'm not going to just stand there like you and..."
"Allison..." Miranda's voice was only slightly more in control.
"You should look at yourself, girl."
I opened the door. They were both standing by the bed. Miranda looked like a young square dancer in her full-length denim skirt and white blouse and bandana around her neck. She wore no makeup, but the color in her face looked healthier than usual because she was angry. Her eyes were bright brown. She picked a twig out of Allison's hair. She had plenty to choose from. Allison had smudges of dirt on her face and dust all down her side. Her red blouse had come untucked from her jeans. She had that same murderous look I'd seen in her eyes that afternoon, but now her eyelids were swollen and red, a few tears smeared in with the dirt. Miranda saw me before Allison did. The singer's shoulders relaxed, just slightly. She said nothing, but her posture invited me in. If I'd been alone in a room with Allison right then, I would have welcomed company, too. "What happened?" I asked. Allison started. She had a little trouble bringing me into focus. She took a shaky breath before she could answer me with something besides a scream.
"Sheck!"
"He pushed you, so you figured you'd just brain him with a horseshoe?" Allison splayed her fingers and brought them up to her ears.
"He moved too fast, I swear to God, the next time..."
Her voice broke. However violent a show she was used to staging, however much she normally got away with, this time she'd surprised herself. The muscles in her face had started loosening up.
"There can't be any next time," Miranda said.
"You could have succeeded in killing him, Allison," I said, easily. Allison managed to refocus on me.
"You're the one who slammed Cam's head into a beer keg, Trace. What? It's okay for you to act that way?"
Miranda gave me a look I couldn't quite read. She seemed to be willing me to say something. I'm not sure why, but just then the room we were standing in came into clearer focus. I realized it must be Miranda's. The burgundy and blue quilt on the bed, the miniature wooden horse on the desk, the dried arrangements of sage and lavender along the windowsill all seemed right for her. A tiny blonde Martin guitar was propped in the corner. A few Daniel's family photographs were framed in silver on the nightstand. It was a strange room, sparse and orderly, but also cozy, definitely feminine. Normally I would have guessed it belonged to a little girl with a tidy mother, or perhaps to somebody's grandmother. Miranda kept giving me a silent request. I looked at Allison. "Why don't I drive you home? You need to get out of here." "Wrong answer." Miranda tightened her lips, but she said,
"That's a good idea."
Allison collected herself. She was just about to agree, I think, when Tilden Sheckley barged into the room. He moved like he was still groggy, but he managed a pretty hideous facsimile of his regular grin. The left side of his face was still mostly blood and dirt. His unruly gray-brown hair was flattened on top by sweat in the shape of his missing hat.
"Allison St. Pierre," he croaked, "I think we need to talk."
Sheck walked toward her. I made the mistake of trying to stop him, figuring that he was still dazed. The next thing I knew, I was sitting on the rug with my jaw feeling like it had just been branded. There was either blood in my mouth or dark beer, Guinness maybe. I don't remember Sheckley's uppercut at all. I certainly didn't have time to block it.
"I'll talk to you in a minute, son," Sheckley said unevenly.
He was focusing a little to the left of my eyes.
"We'll have some words about trespassing in people's offices right now. Stay out of my way."
He grabbed Allison by the wrist. Allison managed to break Sheckley's grip and rake the bad side of his face with her fingernails. But Sheck looked like he'd expected that. He winced and swayed backward, and then smiled, like he'd just been given permission to try again with a little more force.
"Sheckley,"
Miranda said, soft but insistent.
Miranda, darling. He kept trying to get his mouth to work right, to have that normal, smooth tone to it. This ain't your fault, honey. I know that. But you understand what your friend here did? At your daddy's party? You think I'm going to let her walk away from that? Would that be right?
Allison tried for another slap and got her wrist intercepted. The back of Sheck's other hand struck her across the mouth with a sound like a leather belt snapping. Miranda stood frozen, staring at Sheckley's fingers around Allison's wrist. I had no luck trying to get off the floor. Sheck was raising his hand to strike again when Brent Daniels stepped into the doorway and cocked the hammer of his shotgun. Brent didn't need to say anything. Sheck knew the sound of a .006 just fine. Sheck's hand froze next to his shoulder like he was saying the Pledge of Allegiance. He turned around. When he saw it was only Brent, he tried to reconstruct his smile. A little bead of blood dripped off his chin.
Oh, Christ, son, put that damn thing down. You know I ain't.
You step away, Brent insisted. Brent's voice was even and deadly serious. His eyes were still bloodshot, but there was no alcoholic glaze to them, no hesitation and no uneasiness. Brent's eyes were alert and dangerous, and I couldn't quite remember why I'd ever thought of him as dim-witted.
Brent,
Miranda started to say, firmer than before.
Shut up, Miranda.
Sheckley stepped sideways toward the foot of the bed. He wiped at his chin.
All right, Brent. It's your house. Just appears to me.
Get out, Mr. Sheckley. Sheck raised his hand slowly, giving up.
All right, son. All right.
He looked at Allison to let her know nothing was finished. He searched his pocket for a handkerchief and realized he didn't have one. He walked toward Brent until his chest was only a few inches from the shotgun's muzzle.
Can I pass?
Brent stepped aside, silently. Sheckley got a glint of dazed amusement in his eyes.
Marla'd be proud of you, son. Taking up a gun again.
He winked, I think. With his ruined face, it was hard to tell what was intentional and what was just the flesh going into shock.
You cut a fine figure of a man.
Then mumbling pleasantly to himself about all the people he was going to kill, Tilden Sheckley left the room. When he was gone, the barrel of Brent's shotgun lowered to the floor. I got to my feet. Allison collapsed onto the bed. Her hands clenched, but they trembled anyway. She gave Brent a crooked smile, winced, dabbed her tongue into the corner of her mouth, and tasted the blood there.
My hero.
Brent was blushing violently, but I don't think it was from Allison's comment. Miranda looked at him with an expression somewhere between outrage and sympathy.
Oh, Brent. Good Lord, I'm sorry.
Shut up, Miranda,
Brent said again. He was staring at the floor, digging a hole in the rug with a shotgun muzzle.
For once, just shut up.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Lone Star Audio presents an unabridged recording of The Widower's Two-Step by Rick Riordan, narrated by Tom Stecholte.
Chapter 30. I leaned against a cedar post on the Daniels' back porch, staring across the dark field toward the barn where Brent Daniels had retreated. I could only see what was illuminated by the kerosene lantern Brent had hung at the edge of the roof, and from 100 yards away, that wasn't much. The building was apparently half tractor shed, half apartment. On the side closest to me was a curtained window with no light coming through. The field between here and there was scarred with black lines of trenches pocked with mounds of dirt. About 30 yards out was the dark silhouette of a backhoe, some kind of plumbing work in progress. My jaw, where Tilden Sheckley had hit me, throbbed every time my heart beat. My lower gums were puffy, but I hadn't chipped any teeth, and my tongue had stopped bleeding from the hole I'd bitten into it. Compared to Sheckley, compared to a lot of people I'd met this week, I counted myself lucky. Behind me, the party sounds were dying down. The taillights of pickup trucks made little red eyes down Sarah Road and onto Ranch Road 22. Above my head, the bug zapper sizzled every time it said howdy to a mosquito. Once in a while, somewhere out in the fields, a cow or a horse farted. You think I'm kidding? Stay on a ranch sometime. You'll get to know those nighttime sounds intimately. I'd finished my last beer and was now busy shredding the plastic cup into a flower. Allison St. Pierre had ended up getting a ride from someone else. As it turned out, there were plenty of guys ready to fight me for the chance. I didn't fight. I started wondering why I didn't just go around the yard, get in my car, and disappear when the screen door creaked open. Miranda Daniels came out and sat next to me on the railing. She'd taken off her bandana and untucked her white shirt so it fell loose and wrinkled over her skirt. In the black light of the bug zapper, her clothes glowed various shades of violet. Her lips were dark purple. The only thing that didn't change color was her hair. It was so black I couldn't tell where it ended in the dark.
"Thanks for waiting," she said.
"Did you get your dad calmed down?"
"I think so. He's ready for me to quit the recording project. He says it's ruining his parties.
Not to mention his relationship with Sheckley." When she took a deep breath, her collarbone sketched a line underneath her shirt.
"Daddy'd like to see me stay a local performer a while longer, that's a fact. He doesn't trust how fast Les has been taking things. Sheckley and him, they see eye to eye on that."
"And you? What do you want?" She scraped her thumbnail along her palm like she was stroking out a splinter.
"It must look like I'm just going along for the ride, don't it? Letting everybody else take turns steering. Allison's always telling me..."
She stopped, shook her head, displeased with herself for taking that detour.
"I'm really not sure. I wake up different mornings, I feel different things."
"Allison showed me an article in the Recording Industry Times today. They seem to think you'll be rich enough soon to pay off your dad's ranch and buy the rest of Bull Verde, too." Miranda laughed uneasily.
"They're assuming Les St. Pierre will be around to represent me."
"I spoke with Cam Compton, too. He said he told you some ways to make the Century deal happen, some ways that Les could get bargaining power against Sheck." Miranda frowned. She seemed to be casting around in her memories, trying to make a connection. Finally, she found it.
"You mean about Julie? Something about the headliner shows?"
"So he did tell you."
"Cam said a lot of crazy things."
"But you passed the information along to Les."
Miranda shrugged. "I don't... Maybe I did. But not seriously. I told Les it was just crazy stuff. I told him not to do anything stupid on my account."
"But he did." Les started getting close to Julie Kearns. He started digging for dirt on Sheck. She shivered.
"I don't want to talk about this."
We listened to another caravan of pickup trucks rumble and ping down the gravel road. Willis Daniels' voice was coming from the kitchen window now. He was thanking somebody for coming. "You asked me to wait," I reminded her. Miranda nodded, but she didn't say anything. "If you want to convince me how frightening Allison St. Pierre can be, don't worry about it. I've seen the demo." I think Miranda blushed. It was hard to tell in the bug zapper light.
"No," she said. "I feel bad now talking about her the way I did. The minute you left the studio, I felt bad."
"But you're still uneasy about her."
"I don't know. No, let's forget it." The expression on her face told me she couldn't forget it, at least not for more than a few hours. She looked out toward the shed where moths were starting to gather around the kerosene lamp. "You don't approve of her seeing your brother," I supplied. Miranda's expression hardened. "Did you understand about Brandt, about what Sheckley said?"
"Only that the words hurt."
She sat up straighter, pushing her back and shoulders and head against the cedar post like she was going to get her height measured. "Marla was Brandt's wife. She died 2 years ago." The words of the song Miranda had sung the other night came back to me, one of the numbers I couldn't believe Brandt could have written, the Widower's Two-Step. "I'm sorry to hear it." She accepted the condolence with a shrug.
"Marla had diabetes, juvenile insulin-dependent diabetes."
The way Miranda threw that phrase out, as casually as a doctor might have, told me the disease's name had long ago become part of her family's vocabulary. "It wasn't treatable?"
"No, I mean, yes, it was treatable. That ain't what killed her, not by itself. She tried having a baby."
Miranda looked at me, hoping I could guess the rest of the story without her having to say it. I guessed. "That must have devastated Brandt." As soon as I said it, I realized what a stupid observation it was. The man was 42 and still living in a barn behind his father's house. He didn't comb his hair or shave, and he apparently wore his clothes until they rotted off of him.
"For a while there," Miranda said, "Dad had to lock up the guns because Brandt was threatening to kill himself. That's what Sheckley was talking about. Even now I think about Brandt with Allison, the way she might let him down."
Miranda stared at the lantern across the field.
"You know that expression, somebody's life is like a country song? That's us. Mother dying, then Brandt and Marla."
"And you?" I asked.
"It's coming,"
she said it with absolute certainty.
"Mine is coming."
A bug zapper is not normally the kind of illumination that helps me decide a woman is beautiful. But when Miranda looked at me, I decided exactly that. I'm not talking about cute, the vulnerable little kitten quality I'd imagined in her when she'd been on stage at the Cactus Cafe. There was a kind of quiet stubbornness in her face now that suited her well. A much older, steadier light than I'd seen before. "Do you..." I stopped. I wanted to ask if Miranda lived here in the tidy burgundy and blue room I'd seen. I hoped she'd say no, that the room was just a museum to her childhood. I couldn't figure out how to phrase the question and not sound judgmental. As it turned out, I didn't have to. Miranda heard what I was thinking.
"Yes," she said. "I'm afraid I do. Brandt, he didn't have much choice about staying here. Me, I guess it's just a matter of laziness."
There were other possibilities, but it would have been meanness to challenge her. Instead, I said, "Why wasn't it a choice for Brandt?"
"No medical insurance. Marla's medical bills were sky high. If Brandt tried to get work, she would have stopped qualifying for government health benefits. They were forced to stay unemployed. That little shack over there is about all they had, and that only because Daddy insisted. Marla accepted for them. Brandt would have been on the street first. He's too proud."
I tried to associate the word pride with Brandt. It took some effort. From inside the kitchen, Willis Daniels' voice laughed long and hard. He was saying goodnight to what must have been his last departing guest. "What did you ask me out here for?" I said again. Miranda stared at her hands.
"Inside, in my room, you didn't understand."
"I guess not. I thought you were asking me to get Allison out of here." The lights of the last truck headed down Sarah Road. As soon as they turned on to Ranch Road 22, the kitchen erupted with shattering, crashing sounds, like somebody sweeping a cane across a counter full of glasses.
Willis Daniels yelled 4 or 5 obscenities. Then it got quiet again.
No,
Miranda said, not in response to the noise, but like she was merely carrying on our conversation.
I wanted you to take me out of here. I don't give a damn where to.
Chapter 31. I pushed the VW a little too fast, rounding the curves on Ranch Road 22 at 50 miles an hour. The wind blew around the convertible, coming at us from behind. It undid Miranda's hair from the scarf she tied over her head and swept strands of black forward so it looked like they were in a desperate race to beat the rest of her face out of Boule Verde. She made no attempt to push her hair back. 100 yards behind us, a car with cockeyed headlights was following leisurely.
Do you know how to get to Les's office?
Miranda asked the question so softly that I almost didn't hear her in the wind. Sure. We decided I was taking her to the agency's Victorian house in Monte Vista to spend the night. Miranda knew where the emergency key was. She said Les kept a guest room upstairs for touring artists, and she didn't think he would mind her staying there. I was pretty sure she was right about Les not minding. After a while, she reached over and squeezed my forearm. Her hand felt incredibly hot in the cool of the wind.
Thank you. You okay?
Sure. My jaw hurts a little. Miranda let go of my arm.
I'm glad you took that punch.
Because?
For a while there, I thought you were Superman. What with smashing people into kegs and bringing croissants and guns to women in need.
I shook my head. I got red underwear, though. Want to see? She smiled.
Maybe later.
We rounded another curve. The headlights cut a swath across the woods. Light brown ghosts moved behind the cedar trees. Deer, foxes, possums. The headlights behind us disappeared, then reappeared, still about 100 yards back. When we turned south onto I-10, the cockeyed headlights turned with us. Ahead, the clouds glowed above San Antonio. We were still a few miles inside the Avalon County line when the lights behind us started edging closer. About time, I said.
What?
Miranda asked. I slowed down to 40 and the headlights started to gain, then dropped back for a while. I slowed down some more. Finally, they gave it up. A red light blinked into existence on the top of the car and the hand siren started. It was a black Ford Festiva.
What?
Miranda started to say. Probably nothing, I lied.
How many beers did you have?
She asked nervously. We pulled over. I looked in my rearview mirror. The guy coming up on the passenger side looked like a badly shaved orangutan. He had pale skin, brutish features, and a little tuft of orange on top of his head. One hand held up a flashlight next to his ear, and the other hand was under his wrinkled brown blazer. The guy coming up on my side was a stocky blonde in a turquoise polo shirt and slacks. He wore a sidearm. Both men were staying close to the car, cautious.
Phew, I said. I don't think they're carrying a breathalyzer.
They swept the convertible with their flashlights from about 5 feet back. The blonde guy came up to my window. Under different circumstances, I would have said he had a friendly and open face. Big features, red nose, bristly mustache, wide, unwrinkled brow, with a hatband impression still engraved on it. Your basic bubba. Nice guy to drink a beer with. Different circumstances would have been without the suspicious frown on his face and the light shining in my eyes and his left hand resting on his semi-automatic. Howdy, I said. Bubba frowned some more. The guy with the orange hair came up next to Miranda and stared at her, almost resentfully. Ms. Daniels? Miranda looked startled, then seemed to come up with a name she wanted.
Hey, Elgin.
How you doing? How's Karen?
I looked at Bubba. Elgin, that's his code name, right?
Shut up, sir.
Sir, nice. The courteous shakedown. Elgin scratched his little tuft of orange hair, then stepped back from Miranda's window. Then, forward again. He looked uneasy. Poor guy had been planning a nice, easy evening of police brutality, two on one, no ladies present. Nobody that knew his name. This wasn't in the script.
You step out of the car, please, ma'am.
Miranda looked at me for some kind of advice. I smiled. She tried to put that same smile on her face when she turned to Elgin.
Sure, Elgin. I hope there's nothing wrong.
Elgin got her out of the car. He shone his light in my eyes, then swept it through the back of the car.
What's in the case? He asked.
Next to me, Bubba glanced back and sighed.
It's a fucking guitar, Elgin. What do you think?
Then to me, I need to see a license in the papers on the vehicle, sir.
You guys want to show me some ID here?
Bubba stared right through me.
The papers.
Slow and easy, said Elgin. I had a pretty good idea what was coming. I reached for the glove compartment for the insurance papers. I moved very slowly, keeping my hand in the flashlight beam. When my fingers were just about to the glove compartment handle, Elgin swore loudly and drew his 9mm and yelled,
Gun!
Bubba was quick. On the count of one, he had his semi-auto in my ear and his other hand around my neck. By the count of five, I'd been dragged bodily over the car door and slammed into the pavement. One eye couldn't see anything. The other could just make out some fuzzy lights. Something large and hard and sharp was boring a shaft between my shoulder blades. I think it was Bubba's knee. It took him another few seconds to pin down my right arm with his free hand in a fairly decent joint lock. He should have been pressing a little closer to the nerve above my elbow. It's more incapacitating that way. I decided not to volunteer the information. We stayed like that for a minute, maybe less. I couldn't see or hear Miranda, though every once in a while Elgin would say, Just stay back, ma'am. Elgin made a show of searching my glove compartment. It didn't take long for the warmth and wet of the asphalt to soak through my T-shirt. I think there were some pebbles in my left nostril, and my jaw was throbbing again. My neck felt like it had been pried off with a very large bottle opener.
Yo, Frank!
You got it? Bubba Frank demanded.
Yeah,
Elgin said.
Get up,
Frank told me. No, sir, this time. He lifted me to my feet and shoved my chest against the car. He stayed right behind me. Frank and I both looked at Elgin, who was now grinning evilly, holding up a generic .38 with a duct-taped grip.
I suppose you got a license for that,
Frank asked me.
Never seen it before.
He had it,
Miranda muttered. Then, with a little more certainty,
he had it.
She hugged her arms, doing all her pointing with her chin. When she spoke again, her tone was almost apologetic.
Elgin, you put it in the car. I just saw you.
Elgin laughed, a little too nervously. He waved the .38 in no particular direction.
Come on now, Miss Daniels. You know better.
It's called a throwdown, I told Miranda. You're not telling these guys anything they don't know.
But I saw him.
Her tone was soft but obstinate, like a child describing an invisible friend. We were all silent. There were a lot of possible scenarios we could take from here. Most of them I didn't like worth a damn. Elgin looked at Frank for some backup. I couldn't see Frank's face, but from Elgin's reaction I'd say the backup was not forthcoming.
I swear to God, Elgin started. Jesus,
said Frank, disgust in his voice. He put me back on the pavement, not so hard this time, and told Elgin to watch me, if he was up to it. Elgin came over and glared down at me silently. He pointed the .38 casually at my spine.
Then he put his boot on the back of my neck and kept it there. I decided to keep my mouth shut. Sometimes I'm capable of it. Frank took Miranda back to the black Festiva. I had a great view of the VW's left rear tire. The treading was getting worn. A car drove by on the highway, slowed down to look, then kept going. Frank's field radio was telling him something. After a while, Frank came over and told Elgin, "Talk to me for a minute." They walked away from me. I didn't hear the first part of their conversation until Elgin protested something.
"Bullshit," Frank said a little louder.
The conversation got too low for me to hear again, but it was clear that Frank was less than thrilled with Elgin. He didn't even call him sir. Finally, Frank came up to me and undid the cuffs. He got me on my feet.
"Get back in your car."
I did. Miranda joined me, trying very hard not to look at anything. Her scarf had loosened and slipped around her neck, and her hair was a tangled black mesh from the wind. Elgin stared at me angrily for a minute, then caught Frank looking at him and retreated toward the Festiva.
"I apologize for this," Frank told me. "Simple mistake."
"Great," I said. "Tell me about it while I dig the asphalt out of my nose." Frank shook his head. "And if I want to make a complaint with the Avalon County Sheriff's Department?" Frank looked at me blandly.
"You don't."
When we drove away, Elgin and Frank were just starting to have a collegial conversation, sitting on the hood of their car and yelling at each other. My side began to feel a little bit better. Then Miranda started crying. Chapter 32. The Les St. Pierre agency had gotten in the spirit of the season. Somebody, I was betting Gladys the receptionist, had put a clump of pumpkins on the front porch and a ristra over the door. I wondered if Milo Chavez would dress in costume and hand out candy to the would-be recording stars who visited. Somehow I doubted it. Miranda made it all the way up the steps of the old Victorian before sinking down, without explanation, onto the porch. I set her guitar in her overnight bag by the door, then sat next to her. It was 1 a.m, finally cool enough to be pleasant. I didn't feel pleasant. Most of my body weight had drained into my hands and feet. The only thing keeping me awake was the persistent pain in my jaw and my side. Miranda must have been operating on even less sleep than I was. She sat with her upper body listing back and forth, like she was correcting her balance on a ship. She'd stopped crying a long time ago, but her eyes were teary.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I just couldn't believe about Elgin. He and his wife, she's a cousin to Ben French, my drummer. They came to some of my father's parties. Elgin seemed like a gentleman."
"A gentleman," I said, "like Tilden Sheckley." It came out harsher than I intended.
Miranda leaned back until her shoulders touched the wall. She stared across the street at the dark turrets of the Kohler mansion.
"And if I hadn't been there?"
"It's lucky for me you were.
Frank and Elgin wanted to give me something to worry about besides Tilden Sheckley's business." She circled her arms around her knees. She'd taken off her boots in the VW, and now her toes stuck out from beneath the folds of her denim skirt. She dug them in over and over, like she was trying to gather up more of the hardwood porch.
"Sheck was talking to me tonight," she said, "before all that mess with Allison. He asked me about moving out to the mansion."
"What?"
She put her head back and closed her eyes.
"He lives in this old hunting lodge out behind the paintbrush. Got about 6 million rooms in it. Sheck offered me a whole wing to myself and free time at the studio. Ain't nothing like Silo in Austin, but still. Sheck said I'd be closer to the action that way."
"Uh-huh."
She opened her eyes and kicked me lightly on the shin.
"It's not what you think. It would be like an artist colony."
She looked at me uncertainly, like she was hoping against hope that I'd agree.
An artist colony, conveniently down the hall from Tilden's bedroom, I bet. Miranda hadn't moved her bare foot. It still rested against my leg. Maybe she was just too tired to notice. Your father would disapprove, I speculated. But my mind wasn't really on what I was saying anymore. I was looking at Miranda, trying to remember the photograph of her I'd seen in Milo's office 5 days ago. I was trying to superimpose that image, to see if I could remember why I'd found it so hard to believe that Tilden Sheckley would want to own her.
Les would discourage me, too, she added, if Les was around.
I saw what she wanted me to say. I tried to sound as convincing as I could. Les believed in your career, Miranda. He'd have been foolish not to. If he got himself in trouble with Sheck, it was his doing, not yours. Miranda examined my face. She relaxed her shoulders a little.
I just get worried. I'll be glad when this business is decided one way or the other.
I can understand that. Don't do it.
Don't do what?
Move into Sheckley's place. You should move out of your father's and get something of your own, Miranda, but not Sheckley's house. She looked at me differently then. Not tired, not really asking me any question you could put into words. Her foot was still resting on my leg. I cleared my throat. Been a long day. You play tomorrow night?
At the Paintbrush. Every Saturday we open for the headliner.
Well, I stood to go. Miranda offered me her hand. I pulled her up, but she didn't let go of my hand. We walked to the door where Miranda retrieved a spare key from behind the mailbox on the wall. When she opened the door of the agency, the smells of Freon and fresh flowers seeped out, leftovers from a hot day. She turned toward me and smiled.
Good night?
Yeah. My voice came out ragged. I wanted to let go of Miranda's hand so she wouldn't realize mine was shaking a little. She didn't let me. She moistened her lips.
Maybe it's sort of uncomfortable being alone here tonight.
Several different voices were hissing in my ears. Irene Manos and Milo Chavez and Sam Barrera and a bunch of others, all talking about professional detachment and client loyalty and warning me not to start things I'd regret. Miranda kept smiling, and the voices kept